I think I've never seen Laura Cross so transported with joy as she was in the last couple of minutes. Laura was a particularly appropriate person to make the announcements today, because if anyone in Wichita symbolizes the university, she does. And so her presence comports very well with the name of our church. This impressive array of talent is due to the fact that today the choir came back. We think of the church year as starting officially when that happens. And also in honor of those of you who are new members of this church. And before we do anything more this morning, I have a favor to ask of all the members of this church. The most important thing you can do, in my opinion, in the building up of this church is to make it an intimate family where people greet each other by their first names. What is truly pleasant is to walk into the building and have someone say, "Good morning, George. Hi, Betty, how are you?" Much of my joy in coming to this place is to have friends smile and call my name. This impressive group of new members will be bonded to this church much more quickly and much more firmly if you can greet them by name. This morning, of course, they have name tags on, so that effort will not be difficult. But by tomorrow, you may have trouble matching more than three or four names and faces. And a month from now, you probably won't even be able to do that unless you have a plan. So I am begging you to have one. Keep this new list of names and make it a point to match one or two names and faces each Sunday. Find the person. Say, "Good morning, Tony. Hi, Sarah. How are you?" And to those of you who have joined this church today, I have a kindred favor to ask. Don't allow us to take all the initiative. Please set yourselves a goal of getting to know one or two families a week by name and face. We put a pictorial directory in your packet to help you. So maybe little games over dessert in which you cover the names and see if you can identify the faces, give prizes, an extra hug before work, whatever it takes. I am deeply in earnest. We must know each other. There are many things a small church can't do, but this is one that we should be able to do better than any large church, to know each other as if we truly were close friends and neighbors. Please, please make this a priority. The sermon is also related to this reception of new members. I told them a few things about our heritage, but not enough. And so I choose this day of special rejoicing to remind all of us of who we are and where we came from. I told this group that of all the features of congregational faith, the emphasis on responsible freedom is probably unique. Back in the 16th century, when lusty old King Henry VIII threw off the jurisdiction of the Pope, some of the English people rejoiced at the thought that at last they would have freedom in religion, and that the reformation of the church could go forward. But Henry simply put himself in the Pope's place. He got Parliament to make him supreme head of the church, and the link between church and state was even closer than before. Since everybody in those days, regardless of personal conviction, was required to belong to a local parish church And since the individual had no voice in the doctrine or the governing of the church, those who had hoped for more freedom were quite unhappy. Secret meetings were held to talk about it, and by the last third of the century, hundreds of people in London alone considered themselves separated from the established church. Eventually, those people would be Congregationalists. In 1583, the English Parliament passed a law making it an act of treason, punishable by death, to worship in any way except in accordance with the Church of England. Some of these separatists gathered a church in London, much as we gathered a church one Sunday 5 years ago in collegiate school, but their open defiance got them thrown into jail. And when three of their leaders were executed, they fled to Holland, a country that was much more tolerant. In their old English church, there is a plaque today which says, "We are watchers of a beacon whose light must never die." The beacon was the love of liberty, and they are part of our roots. Another is to be found in an only slightly less radical group called the Puritans, because even though they remained in the Church of England, they wanted to purify its doctrine and ritual and give the congregation, the entire congregation, a voice in what happened in the church. As it became more and more difficult for them to stay in the established church, a group of them formed a congregation at a little place called Scrooby in England. They spoke of themselves in a famous phrase as the Lord's free people. And they were joined together simply by an agreement or covenant. Their leaders were highly educated graduates of Cambridge University and later of Oxford. And when they too had to run for their lives to Holland, they ran into some problems. They had planned to sail from a seaport named Boston, about 50 miles from their English home, in the winter of 1607. But the shipmaster tattled on them, and they were put in prison. They got out after a time and tried again, but this time, despite all their care, the women and children were surprised and seized by officers as they tried to board ship. The men aboard had to sail without them and got to Holland after a couple of weeks of very stormy weather, ignorant of the fate of their families. Now please keep in mind that these were bright, God-fearing people whose only crime was that they wanted freedom of conscience. We have sermon tapes, if you should ever wish to share them with friends, which tell in detail the story of the Congregationalists, and I will repeat here only a single paragraph of that story. How slow and terrible the trip was across the Atlantic on the Mayflower. That amazingly tiny little boat, 45 feet wide and 90 feet long. And how it took over 2 months to cross, making less than 2 miles per hour, and then landing sick and weak, not near Virginia, as they had intended, but hundreds of miles north at the tip of Cape Cod with winter setting in. You have all heard as children in school how before the end of that first year, Half of these early Congregationalists were buried. 4 entire families wiped out. Only 3 married couples left. Only 5 of 18 wives surviving. And yet, so strong was their determination that when the Mayflower sailed back to England the next spring, not a one of them got on board to go back to England. And that fall, almost a year after they arrived, there was the famous first Thanksgiving with some of their Indian friends. Those things you know. Here are some things less well known. Since the Church of the Pilgrims in Plymouth had actually been founded in Holland, the Salem Church in 1629 was the first Congregational church to be established in this country. The members agreed to a single, simple covenant statement. We covenant with the Lord and one with another, and do bind ourselves in the presence of God to walk together in all his ways, according as he is pleased to reveal himself unto us in his blessed word of truth. Were you listening carefully? Notice that there is not a word about a creed. They would walk together in the name of Christ as his ways were revealed to them, and as they could for themselves understand and interpret, free from decisions made by a council or a synod. They elected and ordained their own spiritual leaders by secret ballot of the membership. It was the first instance on record of the use of a printed ballot in America. As I read about these early congregational churches, over and over I find the same language. Churches are equal. One has no dominion over another. Each member has complete integrity as a child of God and must therefore be free to believe as mind and conscience dictate. Officers are appointed by the local church, and their rule is only over that church. People are bound not by law or state, but freely in the mutual covenant of love. This was the heart of the congregational way. The Lord's Supper, to be open to all Christians who love the Lord and are trying to live the life of faith, even though they be of a different persuasion. No closed communion. It was a grand vision. I spoke to the class of the connection between these early congregational churches and education. Quite literally, they were responsible for the public school system of America from the elementary grades through high school and college. I mentioned that their early ministers were trained in Cambridge and Oxford, deeply versed in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, as much scholars as they were devout believers. As soon as they were settled in America, they set about to create colleges that would train ministers as they had been trained back in England. So in 1636, they founded their first college. Of its first 12 administrators, 6 were congregational ministers. When one prominent member of the congregational church died in 1638, 2 years after the college had been established, a man who had also graduated from Cambridge, He left to this college his excellent library of several hundred volumes. The college was then named after him in his honor. His name was John Harvard. And the charter of that great university states in part, after God had carried us safe to New England, and we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministry shall lie in dust. If it were possible to demonstrate to you what we have suffered in this country because of an illiterate ministry, you would be deeply grateful to those old Congregationalists for trying so hard to avoid that disaster. Harvard was the only college until 1701, when Yale was founded with the sole purpose of supplying the colleges of this colony with a learned and pious ministry. Dartmouth was founded by Congregationalists as a mission school to help teach the Indians. Later, there was Williams, Bowdoin, Middlebury, Amherst. Somewhere I have a list of about 40 fine schools that owe their lives to the congregational belief in education. The first college for women, Mount Holyoke, was founded by Congregationalists, and then Wellesley and Smith College, all of them standing today as monuments to that early congregational interest in higher education for women. Women played equal roles in congregational churches long before they did so in most other denominations. The congregational churches ordained a woman as minister a century before ordination for women even began to be discussed seriously. I came to Congregationalism late in life, but I had been ready for a long time before I found it, and I was immediately at home. I probably should read to you every year some words from Harry Buttman, a stooped and crippled old veteran of the Free Church, who is, for me, of all the people I have met in national meetings, the ultimate human symbol of what I like best in this church. Harry writes about a time nearly 30 years ago when he and others were fearful that Congregationalists would give up their freedom and become simply another denomination with too much dependence on a national organization. In those days, he says, and now the words are his, I made it a yearly custom to ride a racing bicycle from my parish in Randolph, Massachusetts, down to Plymouth, a round trip of 70 miles. I used to do this during Thanksgiving week as a memorial act. I have poor circulation, and my hands and feet were icy on these late November rides, but I did not go by comfortable car. Let the psychologist make of it what he will. I wanted to suffer a little as I paid my tribute to the men and women who suffered so much. So I would ride to Plymouth, look briefly at the late-placed rock, study the noble bronze visage of Massasoit, walk the banks of Townbrook, and finally climb Burial Hill to tread the holy earth enriched by the mortal dust of these martyrs and witnesses of immortal memory. Then, thinking long thoughts, I would pedal homeward through the deepening dusk, along roads that run through 300 years of memory, with my yellow carbide light for company, past the frozen cranberry bogs, with the night wind sighing in the pines and rustling the dry brown leaves of the scrub oak. And the word that sustained me then, and during the hard struggle to save our heritage, and is with me now, was the epitaph on William Bradford's tombstone, the Latin that translates into strong, memorable English. Let us not basely relinquish that which our forefathers have with difficulty obtained. Our independence in this church, our freedom to grow at our own pace, think our own honest thoughts, and speak them openly, was a gift we did not pay for. It was won at enormous cost. And the men and women who won it had every right to hope that we would cherish it and pass it on intact to those who come after us, to those who one day gathered this church and who have loved and guided it into what we now see, and to those of you who today enter this noble heritage, I say with the strongest conviction of which I am capable, this true freedom is rare, and it is always, in some open or subtle way, under attack. Love it, guard it, and use it well, in His name, to whom we belong. Amen.